The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today with Europe on everyone's mind, we've got Ambrose Evans-Pritchard on the line.
Before we go there, Kevin, there's a couple things that I wanted to address we've covered in the last few weeks and a few clarifications I needed to make. I misstated something last week, which was this. The legislative outlays between 2007 and 2009, they increased by 10%.
What is a legislative outlay?
So we're going to include congressional budgets for salaries, for flights, for in-flight entertainment.
Basically what these guys spend in the legislature.
And so we had an increase, again, during the period of 07 to 09 of 10%. Mm. And I misstated that last week. I said it was 15. Actually, for 2010, it's a 15% increase in a single year. So again, while the recession is being felt by the man on the street, it right. really depends on what part of the economy you're participating in as to whether or not you're experiencing recovery.
So if you're in government, if you're in the decision-making mode or the phase of government, like the legislature, or if you're with Goldman Sachs, this has not been a bad depression at all, has it?
Not bad at all. Now, a couple of other things before we jump into the interview. You're looking at the stock market, Kevin, it's a bit terrifying to me to see that we've already seen deterioration in the internal side of the market. 83% bullish percentages, the trend of stocks in general, has now dropped to 60%. And meanwhile, you've got massive, massive support amongst your money managers for a bullish thesis. For instance, the S&P, according to the Morgan Stanley Monthly Buy-Side Survey, the S&P 500, 79% of money managers are bullish today.
So they're out there putting money into this market.
Emerging markets, 78% are bullish. Crude oil, 63% are bullish. And it goes on and on. But you've got one side of the boat loaded, Kevin, a very bullish side. And that in the face of, looking back a few weeks ago, February 4th, a 97% down day. That's total volume on the New York Stock Exchange. 97% was liquidations. If you look at advances and declines, again, looking at the internal workings of the market.
So 3% were buying, 97% were selling.
If you wanted to look even more broadly, a 1 to 8 advance decline, that is essentially 90% of all stocks, not just the S&P or Dow notables, but 90% of all stocks were trading down. We have some fundamental deterioration in the market, and I would side with our guest of a month or so ago, Bert Doman, in saying that we've already stepped off the cliff. I would watch out below. Richard Russell recently stated about a week ago that we're on our way to retesting the March lows in the 65-6600 range in the Dow. How long it takes us to get there and what the course is that 6 months or 3 years? We don't know, but it would pay to be incredibly cautious. The topic today with Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, Kevin, will be talking about the acute risk in the sovereign debt markets, specifically in Southern Europe, but frankly, the rest of the world is no different, as you've seen a shift from corporate balance sheets and the general public. Those bad debts have just shifted to the public, quote unquote, balance sheet and those sovereign entities. So we want to look at a couple of those things with Ambrose today and a Lehman-style crisis which is developing in Europe.
Well, and just as a reminder, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard was the London Telegraph ambassador, basically, to Belgium when they were putting the euro together. I mean, London was watching the euro come together, and Ambrose was the man who was giving the reporting all through those years. So really, there's no better person to interview as far as what's going on right now with this European meltdown.
Ambrose, thanks for joining us again. There are so many things to look at, either specific issues with Spain, with Greece, with Italy, and the other southern states in the European Union. But on a broader note, there's also the restructuring, if you will, of the EU. What does this look like? Is this similar or very different than what we saw with the exchange rate mechanism? Far more complicated? Where would you say we're at and where are we going?
Well, we've gone a long way from the bust-up in 1992. You know, we now have the euro, which is a much more ambitious project that these countries are locked together in a monetary union in perpetuity. There's no way out of it. It would be absolutely traumatic if any country was forced to leave. So they're going to have to sort of find some solution. Now, just as we're speaking, you know, the European ministers and top officials are all meeting trying to thrash out some sort of formula. What's happened is that the southern European debt crisis has essentially erupted. It's been brewing for a long, long time. the background to this is that when they fixed the exchange rates, basically in the mid-1990s between Germany, the North Europeans, and Southern Europe, the Southern European countries could compete at that point. But over the last 15 years, they've steadily lost ground. They've had higher inflation, higher wage payments, lower productivity growth. And over the years, it has become completely uncompetitive. And the two blocks, North and South, just can't share a currency union anymore. And that's the fundamental trouble. It's finally sort of hit. And, you know, the North European banks are on the hook for roughly 2 trillion euros to Southern Europe, the so-called pigs, which is Portugal, Italy, Ireland, Greece, and Spain. And, you know, so it has systemic consequences for the whole of the banking system. And what we faced late last week, with Greece really getting deeper and deeper into trouble, the credit default swaps, which is gauging bankruptcy risk on Greek debt, were just shooting through the roof. We were having a kind of sovereign version of the Lehman crisis, and just as big, and potentially just as threatening to the global financial system. You know, I thought by late last week, it was getting very, very dangerous. And the Germans were still at that point refusing to bail out Greece, because there are very big, strong political reasons for not doing so. They promised their own people, when the euro was created, which essentially meant giving up the Deutschmark and giving up the Bundesbank and giving up the most precious institutions, that it would never lead to monetary disorder and that it would never leave German taxpayers and citizens on the hook for South European debts. Well, that's precisely what's now blown up. And so the German government, quite understandably, was terribly reluctant to take this huge step. And, you know, they've been dragging their feet for the last 3 weeks, but the crisis was reaching such a point that it was just too dangerous and it threatened to bring down the German banks. So they finally acted. They've thrown their weight behind some kind of EU bailout. And we're going to find out fairly soon exactly what this is going to consist of. But essentially, in some form or other, Europe as a whole is going to have to swallow the liabilities and debts of Southern Europe. If they don't, then this crisis is just going to escalate to a much more dangerous level. But this, of course, has huge political implications, because the euro was created with the European Central Bank, but there's no European Treasury. There's no debt union. There are none of the other elements that you have that go with in a country with its own currency. And there's no fiscal authority. So all the member states are responsible for their own budgets, for running their own economies. This is what has been shown to be unworkable. So they're having to go to the next phase, which is to create, basically mimic some of the institutions you have in the United States to back up the currency. In other words, a kind of federalization, the whole fiscal and economic policy. And this has huge implications for sovereignty. And already we've got Greece, which is the country that's basically on the front line of this and has caused all of this, but it's now effectively under a protectorate of the EU with monitoring, very, very strict monitoring conditions. They're being forced to put through draconian cuts in spending, draconian retrenchment, essentially at the point of a gun, politically speaking. You know, we have strikes in Greece this week. They're going on as I speak, in fact. People are walking in front of the Greek parliament shouting traitor, traitor to those who signed up to this agreement. This is politically explosive. And this is only just beginning. You know, these countries in Southern Europe, especially Greece, but also Spain and Portugal, potentially one or two of the others, are having to go through very, very harsh austerity measures. In Spain, unemployment is already almost 20%. Youth unemployment is 44%. And they're going to have to tighten further very severely. You know, the risk of this turning into, you know, mass social unrest and potentially some degree of terrorism as well, we've already seen a bit of that, is very great, in my opinion.
So we have riots, social unrest, and revolution, which force a focus back to national politics. And yet you say there's no way out. We've made a commitment, or the EU states have made a commitment, and there's really no way to kick out a Spain or Greece. It's not feasible. The cost would be too great for Germany to leave and reintroduce a Deutschmark too.
Yeah, well, essentially looking at it from the point of Southern Europe, they're being asked to do, it's like an IMF emergency package. When IMF comes into a country, it sort of takes over their economy, and normally it consists of two different elements. One is they have to cut spending, retrench. The other, they do a devaluation. The devaluation is what cushions the pain. It's a shock absorber. It allows them some way out of their crisis, regain competitiveness, claw their way back into the sort of world economy, and, you know, make a go of it again. The trouble is, in this case, they're being asked to go through all this IMF-style austerity. They're taking all the pain, but there's no cure. And that's the essential problem here. There's no devaluation. They're just going to have to deflate and deflate and deflate. And the trouble is, Germany's just negotiating a wage deal with the biggest trade union, the IG Metall, which is a zero wage increase this year. So Germany is continuing to cut labor costs, squeezing wages. So how on earth are these countries to regain competitiveness? They lost 30% competitiveness against Germany already since the launch of the euro. How are they supposed to get that back against a country that has, you know, zero wage growth? Well, it's impossible. And so they have to deflate, cut wages, probably for 3, 4, 5 years. And if they do that, their debt, the real cost of their debt, is going to explode. They get into a debt compound trap. It's a classic example of what Irving Fisher described in the United States in 1933. The debt deflation causes the Great Depressions. It's exactly what they're in right now, particularly Spain with very high corporate debt, household debt. Greece has very high government debt. They're different stories, but basically they both have huge debts. Italy has a very high public debt. This is going to compound. It's just going to go shooting up, and they're going to get into a violent debt trajectory, which is in danger of spinning out of control. So the problem is, it's not just a question of tightening your belt and getting a grip. Is it possible? Can this policy actually work? And what I think will occur a year down the road, 2 years down the road, I don't know how long it'll be, and it all depends on the world economy and whether there's a strong recovery or not. But if we don't get a strong global recovery, then I just think the conditions in these countries are going to get so ugly, and they're going to start blaming it on the euro, and they're going to start blaming it on the whole kind of European system, if you like. And so instead of serving as an instrument to bind Europe together, which was the whole point of the euro, it was a sort of political instrument to pull everybody together, a catalyst for sort of federalization of the whole of Europe on the lines of the United States in some respects. It could have the opposite effect. It could cause them all to hate each other, bitter recriminations. And that's the danger. I think it could all backfire, but we'll see. I mean, we'll see how this plays out.
This may be a stretch, but when you use the word federalization, it takes me back to the period of the Civil War in the United States, where you had the industrial North, the agrarian South, and a real conflict of interests. At one level, there was the argument that individual states needed their autonomy, and yet you had the press by the North to keep everything together in one union. And, you know, to a certain degree, it looks and feels a little bit like that. The other thing that seems a bit odd to me is the distinction we're making between Greece and Spain and some of these countries in the southern part of Europe and the United States. Looking at their debt levels and ours, we're as bad or worse in terms of our national debt levels. The Rogoff and Reinhardt study most recently put us at 84% of GDP, debt to GDP, and that does not include Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which would take us to 141%. That exceeds Greece and Spain, and we're talking about a major debt issue in the South. We're talking about the Germans having to swallow a very hard pill, and yet we can pretend as if everything's fine and dandy here in the U.S.
I mean, I think that what's happened in Greece is a sort of global, you know, alarm bell, essentially. It's the first of the sovereign dominoes to fall in this crisis. All the bailouts and rescue programs, the fiscal stimulus programs, shifted the consequences of the collapse from the private sector onto the public sector, onto taxpayer shoulders. This happened across the world, basically. And we're now beginning to see the consequences of this. The public shoulders are not strong enough to bear it. And, you know, Greece is a warning to us all. Greece's public debt, by the way, is going to be 125% of GDP this year. It's higher, quite a bit higher. It's going to be 135% next year. This is according to the European Commission. It's in danger. I'm just reading something by Credit Suisse saying that if they don't get a grip, it'll be 200% by 2015.
Like Japan.
Well, yes, like Japan. That's, you know, that's a whole other story. What it shows you is how fast, once you get above 100%, how fast it can spiral out of control. And it just accelerates at incredible speed. In fact, that's exactly what's happening in Japan. I mean, in Japan, it's 200. The IMF says Japan's public debt will be 227% of GDP at the end of this year. That is gross debt. You've got to be a bit careful because they have an awful lot of assets around the world. They own huge amounts of U.S. treasuries and British gilts, other kinds of stuff, which you've got to offset. You've offset that, I think, it's down to about 110% or something, but growing very fast. They're also on the cusp of this spiral. So we all are. The Anglo-Saxon countries, you know, this is a major risk. France is, and, you know, Germany is not far behind, actually. So I don't see any country that's not in that situation of any major economy of the old world. some of the emerging countries are in better shape. But, you know, so we've all got it. Now, I think if you're in a currency union where you don't have a central bank any longer, you've handed over control of your monetary policy, and you've handed over control of the exchange rate, that makes it a hell of a lot harder. Britain and the United States can both, they can use very, very aggressive monetary policy if they get into deep, deep trouble to try and prevent a debt deflation trap. And in fact, that's exactly what's happening in Britain, where, you know, the Bank of England has bought more government debt than has been issued by the entire government since the crisis began, which is an incredible figure. And the Fed's not been as aggressive, but, you know, you can do these things. And if necessary, they will go even further to prevent a deflationary collapse. The problem is, in Southern Europe, they can't do that. And the countries that are caught in this trap, you know, will the European Central Bank do it for them? No, it won't. It's not even really done any quantitative easing at all, precisely because it's so politically explosive in the Eurozone. They just kept away from it. And secondly, of course, Greece and Spain and the others, they've lost competitiveness within the currency area against Germany and the Netherlands and Finland and so forth. So they can't get that back either. Now, Britain, we've had a devaluation of about 25%. Sterling's fallen since the crisis began. That's acted as a shock absorber. I'm not saying it's a good thing, but it's a necessary condition after the huge boom and excesses we had in Britain. That was a necessary condition before there can be any recovery. We've got to do a whole lot of other things in Britain too, which is massively cut public spending, get a grip on all of this. But the devaluation's part of the cure. Now, in the case of the United States, you know, the dollar's, well, it's recovered in the last few weeks, but it's been relatively weak. And that's, I think, cushioned you, and you're beginning to see a recovery in your exports and your trade is beginning to come back into balance. Certain things are improving. There is some, if you've got your own currency and your own central bank, you can take emergency measures, and that's what saves you in the end. But I don't want to exaggerate this because it's double-edged. If you've got your own currency and you really screw everything up, then you can have a disorderly run on the currency and things can just spiral out of control. And that's a completely different problem. And I would say, I don't think there's much of a risk of that for the United States, but I do think there's a risk of that for Britain if we don't get a grip very, very fast. And we've got an election coming up probably by next May. Neither of the major parties, in my opinion, have fully addressed this issue because, you know, it's too unpopular. And the British people are still in denial and they haven't woken up to the gravity of the crisis yet. So, yeah, unfortunately, there's just a lack of popular understanding of what needs to be done. And neither party is taking the leadership to really break through this. And so we've got a little bit of a Greek problem here. It's just, you know, the public is not really willing to accept the austerity that's needed.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com.
Ambrose, in the last few weeks in our commentary, we've looked at the possibility of a monetary regime change. You know, we had the, from 1717 forward, with the exception of the Napoleonic Wars, you had the British who were on the gold standard, and then very popular from 1870 to 1914, the whole world got on that same bandwagon. It fell apart at World War I. 1922, at the end of the Genoa Conference, we put together a different regime, if you will, the gold exchange standard, and then everyone, with the exception of the Swiss, have been on a fiat system since 1971. It seems to me that one of the grand experiments here, we may be talking about limitations of the European Central Bank, we may be talking about the British Central Bank, the U.S. Central Bank, but we're all playing with paper promises to pay. And it seems that with some historical perspective, one of the things that you guaranteed as a central banker, as a monetary authority in previous generations, was a return to something stable. In the midst of a crisis, you may have to inflate. In the midst of a crisis, you may have to monetize, but there was always the guarantee of coming back to something that made sense and people had trust in. People could put, you know, a stamp of approval, a guarantee, if you will. We're now playing a game that has never been played in the history of the world where you have a universal fiat system. Is there, in your opinion, room for a paradigm shift as we move forward?
Well, goodness, my own view, I mean, in terms of where the global economy is going, I don't believe this recovery is durable. And I think we're seeing contraction of the broad money supply and bank credit in Europe, Japan, and the United States. I think this is baking in the serious second dip and double dip in the latter part of this year. And this is going to be protracted. I mean, I hate to use the term, but I think we're in a depression. I think we've had a kind of sort of minor recovery within the depression. But essentially, this is going to run for several years until we've purged the excesses. My fear is that by the end of it, the governments of the major Western countries and Japan will have debts that are so huge that there'll have to be a jubilee. And the jubilee will just be mass cancellation of debts and mass default. And it'll probably be done through inflation. So the way I see it is we have a deflation crisis first. They massively go into overdrive, use the printing presses until they get us out of it, and then it flies out of control because it's very hard to stop. Once you use that mechanism to an extreme level, it sort of comes back and hits you. I think that's how I see it playing out. There will effectively be devaluation of debt. So then at that point, your question is, well, are paper currencies essentially discredited and fiat central banks discredited? And I would say, well, we're halfway there already. I think what they did in the last 25 years has already called into question whether you should have the governments with these monopoly over the monetary system through central banks, because I think they kept the interest rate too low for much of the last quarter century. They fixed by government sort of order, if you like, the price of credit too low. And by doing so, they sent the wrong signal to the markets. The markets responded to this by creating credit bubbles globally. So I see this as not as the markets having gone wrong. I see this as the governments having created a condition that pushed the markets into these stupid excesses. Had there been a genuine free market functioning, genuine free market for credit, and had credit not been set by governments around the world, we wouldn't have got to the extreme point it reached. It would have been popped earlier. It would have corrected earlier with less damage. I think the central banks have already disgraced themselves, frankly. And I think they're now going to have to use such radical measures to get us out of this mess. It's going to take a long time. But by the time we finished, people will want a much more clearer store of value, whether it's some kind of restored gold standard, or, you know, or what the Chinese have been talking about as a mixed bag with different commodities. It's kind of what Keynes talked about after the Second World War, because he didn't want it to be gold because he thought gold was deflationary. He wanted something with a broader base that included all industrial metals and so forth. Some hard core to it uses a basket as to weight a currency. That's possible. Whether there could be some kind of a global currency coming out of it based on some kind of IMF special drawing right structure, I don't know. It's possible. I mean, my guess is, if you really want my guess, is actually, despite all the problems in the United States, the U.S. will come out of this better than most of the other big countries, and partly because it has the best demographic structure of all of any of the major developed countries, much better than Europe, much better than Japan, actually much better than China as well.
Correct.
So I think the U.S. will come out of this okay, and it still has huge scientific, strategic resources which will carry it through. And I see the 21st century being a kind of century of an American-Chinese condominium where they sort of run it together, and hopefully they run it together in a reasonably amicable way. That's our only hope.
No, it's been consistent, you know, as we've been discussing things with you over the last couple of years, that, you know, whether it was first in, first out, you've had several comments along the way which have implied that the U.S., although it has its issues on a relative basis, comes out better. Again, whether it's demographics, whether it's something like our Tier 1 capital ratios, which are significantly better than Europe today, there's many ways in which we distinguish ourselves. It doesn't mean that we don't have significant problems to solve.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you take your pain up front, you're more transparent. For all the sins that occurred in the banking crisis, I mean, at least most of it's out there now, and we know roughly where we are, hopefully. They took their hits early on, whereas it's been covered up in Europe, and we still don't know what's going on. You know, one of the reasons why, you know, the French are desperately trying to put together this deal for Greece is that the French banks have 80 billion euros of exposure in Greece alone, and, you know, we don't, you know, Germany has absolutely colossal exposure to Spain. And the German banks have the lowest risk-adjusted capital ratios in the world, other than Japan. You know, what happens if Spain gets into, you know, really, really there's danger of default, or start taking a big haircut on those loans to Spain? I mean, the German banks are going to go down. This is because they haven't come clean on it. And so America, for all its faults, you know, it looks, you always get this every time there's a crisis. It usually starts in America. It's partly because of the cycle. But also, you know, you look awful for a while. Everybody in Europe pokes fun at you. And then, oh, my God, we got same problem. And then it turns out it's actually worse in Europe. But it takes much longer to come to the surface because they have all sort of ways of disguising it and covering it up. And I think that is going to become apparent again, that the end of it all America will emerge in better shape from this than Europe.
A last comment from you, perhaps, Ambrose, is we look at the political implications of things happening around the globe. Does this take us closer to, in resolving the issues of our day and the crises of our day, does this take us closer to a central planning model like Brussels, or is this, in fact, something that breaks that kind of cohesion both in the United States and globally in terms of either things becoming more socialized or less over the next 3 to 5 to 7 years as we sort out these issues at a fundamental level?
Yeah, that's a very hard one to call. I see three sort of phases to this global crisis. You know, the first was the U.S. subprime and credit bubble popped. The second is the European bubble popped with Club Med, essentially, and Eastern Europe and Club Med going belly up. And that's, you know, we're seeing that now reaching its sort of crescendo. That needs to be dealt with. It needs to be, you know, got lance the boil, get it all out there in the market. Everybody knows what it is. And then the China one's got, you know, I also think the China overinvestment bubble is just completely out of control. And I know people have different views about this. I think it's a repeat of what Japan did in the late 80s. And I think China will recover and will carry on to be a major and dominant force in the world. I think it's going to have a big, big, you know, a rough time for a few years as this is sorted out. In terms of how, whether we swing to, look, I think globalization has had its peak. I think we're going to go to period where people retreat more back into kind of national economies or regional blocks. We're going to have a much more protectionist era. I think politically the pendulum is going to swing to the left probably more than to the right, although that's not been the case so far. Certainly in Europe, there's mostly been center-right governments that have been winning the elections. Obama won in America, so swing to center-left. Hatoyama won in Japan, swing to center-left. So it's a mixed picture. I think at the end of the day that there's going to be less market, more government, a higher state share of the economy across most of the big countries. I think that's going to be the outcome probably the next generation. And then when that's seen not to work very well, then we'll swing back to the free market. But I think the damage done to the reputation of the free market, even though I think it's unfair, and even though I think the governments were the main agents of this crisis, has been so great that I think that, you know, we're going to see that expressed in politics for, you know, 20 years.
Well, Ambrose, thanks for joining us, and we'll look forward to carrying on a discussion in the future.
Hopefully it'll be less gloomy next time.
Yes, thank you for joining us today, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or you can give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.